This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network, and I am super excited to have my very special guest today, Raghunath. I hope you don't mind me mentioning Ray Capo of Youth of Today and a lot of amazing yoga and punk rock and hardcore fame, but fame doesn't really, I don't know if that vibes in the our punk rock thing, but it's part of what you do.
It's part of
who you are, and we're going to talk about that. But I did. You have a really brief bio that I wanted to share from your website that I know just newly launched. That says Raghunath tours the world, leading kirtans and the practical applications of yogic philosophy. He annually takes a group pilgrimage through holy places of India, and. That's a pretty brief bio. I know there's so much more to get to.
You know what? That's not my official bio. The web guy, I think, that just took a few things online. I haven't updated it yet. But
so what else?
This whole show could be my bio. I think it's sort of interesting for your people, as well as our past will cross.
Yes,
and paths have crossed again at Wanderlust Snowshoe this year.
Yeah,
that was really great. Grateful about it because, you know, I've been teaching yoga. You know, I started teaching yoga in Beverly Hills, of all places. My background is I'm a punk kid from the Lower East Side, going to CBGBs in the Lower East Side in the early 80s. And so somehow I ended up in Beverly Hills teaching yoga and became a very popular teacher there. No one had any clue of my past punk rock life.
Right.
And I sort of didn't know to share it because Beverly Hills was sort of like a peculiar place to share stuff like that. So generally, I led a parallel life, and that those bands were still big. They're still strangely popular. You know, I'm doing a reunion this week, you know, a 30-year anniversary for Revelation Records, and
right.
It sold out, in Los Angeles, and then in Philadelphia, Shelter, my other band, is doing a big reunion on July 30th. And it's something I don't do regularly, but basically those bands, they were like seminal bands in that music genre. So they still have some life, you know, they still have some life to them, strangely. I'll get some royalties occasionally. And what'll happen is the two worlds never collided, especially there in Beverly Hills. But once I moved back east, every now and then in a yoga class, someone goes, wait a second. I know who you are, which that's like been the story of my life, because it's not like I'm John Lennon where people are, you know, Michael Jackson, where people jumping me and mauling me on the streets.
Right.
And my wife, who knows nothing about my musical background, when we were married, every now and then some person would just go, holy crap. Oh, my God, you're you. Like,
yeah.
You know, but it wasn't every day, but it was like, but when they see you, it's like bigger than life. And I think because the scene that we were in, you know, it was at a time where people were like, you know, teenagers going through their life crisis. Who am I? Their identity. What do I want to do with my life? And both those bands I were in were very sort of like pivotal, I think, in a lot of kids to like make certain changes. You know, Youth of Today was big in clean living, vegetarianism.
Yeah.
And those are big lifestyle changes, which still affect people 40 years later, 30
hugely.
Years later.
And that's why, like, I, not fully, but like when I was so jazzed to finally meet you, it's like, yes, Raghunath. But in my heart, I told you, like, it's Ray, you know, from my teenage years. Like, oh man, like, so cool I get to meet you and see you. And it was really special to finally, like, share a little time with you out in West Virginia recently. But I mean,
and I like to connect people who know that scene as well, too.
Right.
And that snowshoe in the middle of West Virginia, I met about five people, at least five people that right. were like, hey, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you can tell them covered with tattoos and they're, you know, they do yoga or they, you know, show up with their girlfriend or husband or something like that. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And they heard about the crossover, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a kind of natural intersection for a lot of people. And you and I discussed that because for us, when we're finding punk and hardcore, we're looking for something more. Something deeper, right? Like this world is so messed up. I need to make sense of it. How can I make sense of it? And that's
probably
a start.
We needed, like, it was our alternative out of mainstream culture, which, like, this can't be right.
Right.
And then we turned to alternative music or alternative lifestyle.
Right.
And then we sort of get drawn to, like, band. And we would say, wait a second, this band is alternative, but they're worse than the mainstream. Yeah. Or, like, the things propagating are worse than the mainstream. And so we got drawn into things of, you know, cleaner living and, you know.
So tell me a little bit about that. And we're going to jump into the yoga because I know that's your main passion today. But I also honor that you respect your roots and you do these reunion shows. And you know how excited kids get to go see Youth of Today again in Shelter. And I know Kylie, our friend, or others know her as Kate 108, just like did a few songs at a 108 reunion. And people were freaking out because that was huge, man. Like, that's a deeply instilled part of our youth, you know, and that's still with us today. So youth of today, that was totally unintended. But I mean, you know, if you could share a little bit, because, you know, we're both from Connecticut, you know, and I know Youth of Today wasn't your first band, but you just even briefly talk a bit about your experience with that and how that led you eventually into whether it was Revelation Records. And then I know Krishna Consciousness. I'd love to hear that backstory.
Very interesting time historically for the music industry. You know, this was the time where there are, like, huge record labels, and it was almost like untouched by a kid who wanted to be in a band. I was looking for an alternative. By the time I hit 10th grade growing up in Danbury, Connecticut, I wanted a sort of like a secret door out of that world and into some mysterious world. And because I had older brothers and sisters that lived in Manhattan or New York, and my parents are from New York City, that I used to just visit New York City on weekends and start to wander around the Greenwich Village, the East Village, and I was a music fan, and I started stumbling upon, you know, these underground nightclubs. And back then there was like no age limits. You can go to Danceteria or the Mud Club, right, Irving Plaza or the Ritz, you know, or the Ritz and, Peppermint Lounge, and we used to just like go to clubs, see live bands, and the U2 was playing at the Ritz. It's like, what's the Ritz called? Webster Hall. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the Go-Go's, Bow Wow Wow. This was like early 80s. Things have gotten, you know, Black Flag. And then next thing you know, you're sort of like, you run into some, you know, you're 15 years old. You go back on a Monday to your normal high school, and everyone's like, what did you do this weekend? Oh, I went to a party. You had a keg party. I was like, man, I was up all night watching these bands. These guys were like teenagers from like, and it was like shocking when I first started seeing like punk and hardcore back then, which was sort of like at its sort of birth or new birth.
Yeah,
there was nothing in the world like it. And I remember that first show where I saw the Beastie Boys first band, and these guys were my age, so their first band was called The Young and the Useless, and they were playing. You know, these are bands that no one had records out.
Yeah.
And then that was the year they started manufacturing. People started manufacturing their own EPs, extended play, 7-inch. And you could make your own covers. And it was like a manufacturing your own record. It was like the beginning of taking the music industry back into your own hands.
Mm.
Away from big record producers, away from major labels. And the band said, you know, I'm going to start a band. We're going to put out our own record. We're going to make 1,000 of them. We're going to sell them to our fans. And there was a whole scene for that.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And that was the beginning, at least the punk and hardcore scene, of manufacturing your own records. There was like only three records in New York. There was like Young and the Useless, Kraut, which was a great band from Queens, and Heart Attack was another great band. No one had records out. I became a fan of that. And a girl was with me at the time said, Ray, you could do that. You could get up on stage like these guys. Are you? I was like, you know, I think I could do that. And that after that show, I went back, grabbed a bunch of like alternative freaks from my high school, which we were like sort of our own freaky self. And this was before like a punk thing was even anywhere near anything. Like there was nothing. If you were a punk in a high school in Connecticut in 1982, consider your ass kicked. You know what I mean? It was that ridiculous. You know what I mean? It was just like unheard of. And, you know, but that made us like dig our heels in deeper. You know what? I want nothing to do with you people. I'm going to go to New York every weekend. I'm going to go there during the summer and hang out. And we developed the whole like second life. From there on, to wind the story quicker, by the time I was in a band, but my band that got really popular quick was Youth of Today.
Yeah.
And Youth of Today was very bold statements about we don't drink, we don't smoke, and into Sense Control, the twist of spirituality, and we became and strict vegetarians. And at that time, no one was sort of like, you know, the interesting thing, I was just talking to my friend who's in advertising, and he's like, you are like, should go into advertising world and branding. And I was thinking everything we did was branding before we understood the concept of branding.
Right.
But the record label we started from that was a type of branding that, you know, it was a look, it was a fashion, it was a language, it was a hairdo. It was like, you know, there were logos and fonts and stuff. And we did it without even really thinking about it. It just became that. And from that statement, a very bold statement of clean living in a very, very unclean living scene, we became hated. And with everybody that hates you, there's a bunch of people that are like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And like sort of a bubble within a punk scene. Because when people think of punk, they think of like insanity and craziness and, you know, lethargy and a drunk guy on the street with leopard skin pants and, you know, sleeping out all day. But we were actually a very clean cut, self-control, looking higher, positive mental attitude. And it sort of like took the scene by storm because it happened so fast, and then it spread very quickly internationally.
Yeah.
The point it was like, you know, 4 years ago I did a reunion in Moscow and St. Petersburg and stuff like that to like sold out shows. It was just like weird, peculiar things I would never think would happen because it was never a plan.
Right.
We just – these are important principles we've got to talk about. And then so many other bands formed around us sort of – within that community that we said, you know what, we had some foresight thinking, you know what, who knows how long this bubble is going to go. We should document this, sonically document it. And we started releasing all the bands on our own label called Revelation Records. As a matter of fact, I'm leaving tomorrow to do a 30-year reunion with the band. We have four headlining nights. So we played the first the whole weekend sold out. We play Thursday night, and then some other bands from the label will play every other night. So this is like a peculiar phenomenon that 30 years later, people still give a crap. The people that come to the show are in their 40s or they're 18 or 17. Right. Very peculiar. And, you know, I was just teaching yoga in Italy last month and Switzerland and Germany. And I ran into fans who were like, oh yeah, we're flying out for that show. Of course we're going to fly out for that show. It was one of those type of things.
Yeah. I mean, because it has such deep roots for so many of us. I know I said that earlier, but really, like, you and I discussed this in West Virginia. You were the generation right before me, but I too grew up in suburban Connecticut. So while you had paved the way and bands like Inside Out and, you know, a whole bunch of Burn and a bunch of other rev bands, I came up that next generation where same deal, very suburban athletic community where if you're not partying or an athlete, like I have to give credit to my friend Bernie. He was is in this incredible band Cable on Hydrahead Records. And I started learning about not just Youth of Today, but Snapcase and Neurosis and Isis and all these genres that started like morphing, and like Mouthpiece and Chokehold and of course Earth Crisis and Strife. And it's just like the list goes on and on and on. And that's what we were doing, same as you. And but when you said 82, I'm thinking, well, shit, this was like 92, 93. Yeah. And I actually just posted a video from 95 I came across of freaking Earth Crisis at the Bristol Skate Park here in Connecticut. And it was just like, and I see myself and I see all my friends and we're like 14 or 13. And it's like, look at us. Like, but that meant the world to us because we weren't identifying with our surroundings, you know? And so of course, like that stuff still means so much to us today. Well, most of us at least. So.
Yeah, for sure. It's like it created us what to speak of if there were sort of like ethical principles or principles like, I mean, we'll get messages to this day of like, oh, you saved my life 20 years ago. I was addicted to A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
And you spoke at a time when I really need to hear it. And sometimes people really need to hear a message of goodwill, caring, concern, wisdom when they're 18 years old. And they're not going to hear it from their dad, or they're not going to hear it from their mom. Or maybe their dad's got his own problems, or their mom's got their own problems, or they're divorced and these kids are struggling. So – you know, it could have come off corny, what we did. In retrospect, I'm completely – and it was probably. You know, let's hear a 19-year-old kid telling you, don't drink. You shouldn't drink it. You know, drink alcohol. Like, screw you. I'm 19 years old. But they were sort of like – I always had a strong spiritual calling from childhood. And I was open to different paths. And my idea was if you write songs that have spiritual messages – they'll stand the test of time forever. And I used everything from Bible, Buddhist sutras, New Testament, Bhagavad Gita to sort of help me, like, guide me. And you can see it, like, in the lyrics that you read.
Yeah.
And it was corny. And it was also, like, a teenager's version of reading wisdom literature. You know what I mean?
Of course.
In the sense control. Control your mind, you know. You know, don't screw people over, you know,
right.
You know, see the lighter side of things. Don't find fault with people, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was basically, it's an extended message of what I'm doing now.
Right.
In yoga community and teaching sacred literature and stuff like that. It was just for a different audience. And so that's why I morphed into, you know, leaving the music scene at one point and then becoming a monk for about 6 years, living in an ashram for total of like 7.5 years.
So let's talk about that, because so hardcore inevitably it led you to play in Shelter, which is a Krishna conscious band, and you know, and Equal Vision Records is happening around this time. We also have bands like 108 and Prima and, you know, other great bands. So I'm sure, or I'm guessing, that was the time where you were starting to either find or really take your path seriously. Or am I off on that? I'd love to hear now, how you...
You know, the timeline was sort of like, I got to the point of, well, I didn't really want to create a scene of a bunch of people that just are self-righteous about not drinking or not smoking or not eating meat. To me, it wasn't about just saying no to everything. It was about, I want to spiritually evolve. So for me, that calling was to let go of these things. I had to purify my consciousness, purify my palate, purify my thoughts. So for me, it was sort of like, I'm on a path. But it became really quickly, and this happens with everything. It happens with this music scene. It happens with veganism. It happens with animal rights. It happens with raw foodism. It happens with religion. It's like whenever you do something for self-betterment, it's, if it's done without humility woven into it, we become incredibly arrogant.
Yeah.
Who wants to, like, have you ever met a vegan that hates your guts? You know what I mean? or anyone, a religionist that hates your guts, or, you know, oh, you're not raw, you're vegan, but you're not a raw foodist. You know, you don't juice, you know, you're not gluten-free. It's whatever it is. I do it for self-betterment, but it just becomes an ego trip. And my theory with that is if what you're not – or how I teach my students, if what you're doing for self-betterment is not making you love more people all the time – you're doing something wrong, if, especially if it's turning you, I hate this group of people, then you're doing something very, very wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so that's it's sort of like a red flag goes up. I'm into this self-betterment and I should love more. I should be more tolerant. I shouldn't be less tolerant. I should be more tolerant. If anything I'm going to be hard on is that what I got to work hard on myself. I can be strict with myself and completely lenient and tolerant with others. That's the mood, you know, and that's the mood how where I teach from. And so in this straight edge scene, especially in the animal rights scene, it became just like an ego trip. And I realized I didn't want any part of this. And for me, it was and there was a problem because I was the guy who sort of spearheaded the whole thing. And there was a time I just said, you know what, I'm going to quit it all because I think there's something higher calling me. And at that time, I went to India. I got very serious, became like a celibate monk for about 6 years. And it wasn't until a few years later and the studying of the Gita, which is such a beautiful, you know, and the seminal literature on yoga, is that when you study the Gita, it doesn't teach you to renounce what you're great at. It's see what your gift is and use that gift in a way that purifies your consciousness instead of degrades the consciousness. We all have gifts, and that gift, for example, suppose you're charming. You know what I mean? I mean, you can use charm to be a complete jackass.
Yeah.
You know, how many times have a person dated charming jerk, you know? But you can also use charm in a wonderful way to change the world. You know, Gandhi was incredibly charming.
Yeah.
You know, there's people that charm that use that charm for great things. So it's not about that charm's good or bad. It's sort of like electricity. It can freeze like a freezer, or it can burn like a stove, or a knife can kill, or it can save a person's life in an operation. So the concept of what am I going to – it's not what I got. It's what I do with what I got. So when I started really imbibing the Gita, I was like, oh, I get it. I gave up music. Music, fame, popularity, those were just energies like electricity. It's not necessarily evil. But if it's not channeled in the right way, it can burn you up. Right. And that's why – so many of the world religions have all this thing about the dangers of wealth or the dangers of associating with very beautiful people or being attached to, you know, it's not that those things are so evil. It's that people can't handle those energies. Right. So if you take those energies and use them in a way that's purifying, music's divine if you use it in a divine way. Wealth can be divine. That's why they in India they say wealth is Lakshmi, because Lakshmi is part of Vishnu. You know, so Lakshmi should be used to serve Vishnu, just like when we study the epic Ramayana. Sita is Lakshmi. Ravana steals Lakshmi or Sita. And Hanuman returns Sita or Lakshmi to Ram.
Right.
So the idea is we all have some great qualities. They're all going to be completely different. As you write or I do music or somebody teaches or someone's an artist or someone's in defiant, whatever it is, there's some special gifts that we have, and we had to give back with those gifts. So that was the idea when I started Shelter, was I can't bury this stuff. This music runs through me, and I was an influential person, and that influence can be used in a wonderful way. And if I learn how to harness that fame, then envy won't arise, greed won't arise, lust won't arise, anger won't arise, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, all these things that the yogis and the sages talk about, it won't arise if I use them in a proper channel. And that was my goal with Shelter. And it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
We were all very strict monks.
Yeah.
And we'd go on tour and we'd come back. And we'd go back. We'd go out on tour and we'd come back. Then we'd go to India on sabbatical and just study and just, you know, have this strict sadhana regulated life. And then we'd go back on tour. And it was just like that for years.
I remember seeing you guys many times. I think it's Studio 158, and you were there. You had your table set up. There was the Gita as it is. There were the mala beads. There were the tongue scrapers. It was like the whole.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, it was called our bazaar, yes. Where we'd go to India, buy everything in the bazaar, and just sell it. And that's how we'd support ourselves on the road. We just live in the road in a van.
Yeah.
You want to hear something else pretty funny? Because the concept in ashram life is health, and this is so funny because Americans have this crazy idea of health. It's like, oh man, I've been eating like crap all these years. Now I'm going to eat a bar because a bar is really healthy. It's like so insane. Like a bar is healthy. You know what's healthy? Food cooked with love for people that you love and eaten with people that you love. So this concept of love behind the food is such a big part of Vedic philosophy, of yoga philosophy.
Yeah.
And so therefore, there's a whole concept wherever you go to holy towns, people are giving you prasad, right, food offered with love, cooked with love, offered to the deity, and then distributed. So on when we were on tour with monks, we would never eat food that was cooked by people of not of spiritual consciousness. Mm. So we wouldn't eat at restaurants. We wouldn't eat prepackaged foods. We'd bring our own Brahmin cook with us and set up like a candy stove wherever we'd go. We wouldn't eat packaged anything. We'd eat fruit. That would be the closest thing. Otherwise, we'd cook all our own grains, make all our own chapatis or flatbreads on the road. And that's how we traveled around the whole United States and Europe. Yeah.
You guys must
– fascinating. And we were all celibate monks.
Yeah.
It might have been the first time historically that any band was.
And I'm wondering if you guys, because I honestly remember I covered the first two Warped Tours back in the early 90s, and I very specifically, the polar opposite, remember there being Krishna conscious people in the back cooking food. And I don't know if that was because one of the bands brought them there. You know, I'm thinking like Quicksand was on that tour and Deftones, and I don't think Cro-Mags did the first two, but you guys were not on either of those, were you? The first couple?
We played Asbury Park. We played a few Warped Tours.
Maybe that's what it was.
Not the whole tour, it's just one-off shows.
Yeah, these were more up in the Northampton, Mass area, but I remember like how very serious they were about the food, and that was my first time actually learning about how important it is to cook, and then later on reading Ram Dass and learning from Maharaji about, you know, never eat anything unless it's made with love. And he would often
difference.
Yeah.
Makes all. And we're so concerned about like, I'm going to eat spirulina and chlorella. You know what I mean? But it's like, or we're overly concerned about. It's just a warped idea of health, I think.
Yeah.
And then there's all, but it's everything too. It's everything that we put into our ears. I mean, our not just our mouth, but our ears and our eyes. Like, watch what we consume through watch the media that we consume or the books that we read, because it's starting to create our whole consciousness.
Yeah.
The way I raise, I have five kids too. So, the raising of my children, we're very careful, the media they consume. And they don't, we don't grow up with TVs. We don't grow up. Occasionally I let them watch a movie or something. We're very careful about the movie they consume. And it keeps them, at least as children, it keeps them children.
Yeah.
Right now, culture, it just makes kids become adults very quick.
Sure.
It gets very creepy as well.
Yeah.
We have this whole very, conscious way of raising kids.
And so tell me about that. I mean, we'll go back to yoga and what brought you there, but I know you own a farm in upstate New York, and tell us, I would love to hear more about that.
You can see it out our window right now. But
beautiful.
We have a place called Super Soul Farm. It's been sort of like a dream of ours for like 20 years.
Yeah.
We want to start a center where we could teach from, where we have teach classes on yoga philosophy, yoga lifestyle, kirtan, music, sacred literature, and also how to live with the land and learn how to assess the land. Where's a good spot for water catchment? Where it gets a lot? Where does it have more sun? How can we farm organically and use the oil, the soil that we have, and how can we remediate the soil so it's useful? What trees do you have on the property? What grows well here? How can animals be? Because I understand veganism in the sense like we've screwed animals so bad that we want nothing to do with it. So what happens with a lot of like people who want to do better is we create reactionary movements where we've abused animals. Now we want nothing to do with them. Mm. Actually, no, we can have a symbiotic relationship with animals, symbiotic relationship with plants, a symbiotic relationship with other humans. You know what I mean? We just don't, just because I've had bitter relationships doesn't mean I should cut out all relationships. Right. It means we should have nurturing relationships. So we have a lot of animals on the property. For example, we have ducks. Ducks do this wonderful thing of eating slugs. And you don't have a slug problem in your garden. You have a duck problem. You're just down on ducks. You know, chickens have an incredible ability to be manure spreaders. They get into manure and they just spread it around. They also eat ticks. You know what I mean? If people eat eggs, they have eggs. We don't, I think half my family is divided about eating eggs, but I don't eat eggs. But you can also use eggs for the other animal. My dog eats the eggs, or you can bury the eggs and fertilize the soil. And then we have peacocks just because they're beautiful to look at, guinea fowls. We have sheep. Sheep are incredible mowers. They're mowers that don't use gasoline or petroleum or fossil fuels. They eat grass. And yeah. What do they give back? They give manure, which makes the soil 80% more fertile than if you had no manure on it. So we're caught up, and so we're trying to create like these closed loop systems where everything you have is giving some return, giving some yield, and you're putting it back into itself.
Yeah.
Whereas otherwise, we create these systems where, like, okay, we want our lawn to grow, so we put fertilizer on the lawn. That fertilizer ruins the soil. It contaminates the water table. Your whole place becomes toxic. Or we use hydraulics for everything. We need tractors for everything. I'm not saying, like, we never use the things, but we should see the long-term vision for where things are going. Mm-hmm. And the more we break out of a natural cycle of things, the more we create more problems. We don't create less problems. These time-saving devices are creating more problems. So what, not just myself, but a lot of people who live up where we live, which is upstate New York, they're just a lot of like New Yorkers are just like, you know what? I'm opting out. I'm opting out of living in the city. I'm opting out of raising my kids in the city where they're precocious and grow up too quick. And they're just like absorbed in their iPhones and their iPads at an early age without any discernment. I mean, adults have hardly any discernment when it comes to social and stuff like that. So what to speak of an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old who are getting like the public school is giving them iPads in kindergarten. And it develops this, you know, and then you're watching so much intense video games or movies. You send a kid outside to a waterfall and they'll be like, this is boring. You know what I mean? Because they're so overstimulated. Get the kids back connecting with nature. That's their school. You know, to learn how to plant things. That's their school. To learn how to relate with animals. That's their school. Yeah. To learn how to knit or to make, you know, we have to shear the sheep because it's you know, it's getting too hot. So we shear the sheep, sit them down, take the wool, clean the wool, and then spin the wool. And then knit with the wool. You know what knitting is? All these old, you know, primitive skills.
Yeah.
Each one of them are meditative.
Oh, yeah. Each
is like meditation. So we don't say abandon animals. We say work with animals, you know, and love the animals.
Yeah.
You know.
You gave a really great story, and I hope you don't mind sharing it again. About sheep and in relation to how sometimes on the farm as their wool grows, you know, they can knock a fence over and that can let like a wolf. And I think you used a wolf or a predator as an example. And you were sharing in relation to, you know, taking care of ourselves. And yeah, I don't want to give too much away.
But I remember that story. It was in relationship to self-respect. Self-respect, and I was using the analogy of the sheep because sometimes due to our own lack of self-worth, you know, I was talking about this in class this morning too. Sometimes we just – see, we're pure beings. According to Vedic philosophy, there's a pure soul theory. We are pure beings.
Yeah.
But just like if I'm sitting out my window right now and the window is – got a bunch of eggs thrown at it, but I can't barely see what's going on. If someone painted the window red, everything appears red outside. If someone paints it yellow, everything appears yellow. So according on the coloring of my lenses of how I see the world, how I see myself, that could be a problem. Not because I'm not pure, but because the lens of my mind has been colored by previous experience. It could be my father abandoned me. It could be my father beat me. So these things, even a modern psychiatrist would say, yeah, these childhood traumas, they've left an effect on your consciousness and how you see the world, yeah. The people you check to be, choose to be in relationship with, your lack of self-worth. Now the yogis take it another step further. They say, well, that father that was abusive, you chose him. You know, you've been making these choices for a lifetime. So there's like a primordial issue you got. It's not just didn't happen from your father.
Right.
You've been making these choices. You're responsible for these choices, believe it or not. So anyway, to take this a step further is we, due to our own lack of self-worth sometimes, we choose people that are like predators. Mm-hmm. People are preying on us, and that we should have high fences. And I gave the example of the sheep. We have electric fence to contain them, not because the sheep are evil, but because predators want to come in because they're so helpless, and they'll kill them. They'll rip them apart.
Right.
You know, there's coyotes around or bobcats or something, and the sheep are so helpless. So you keep an electric fence to keep the predator out. But sometimes the sheep do their big will and will knock the fence over, and then any predator to get in. And so I said this thing like, have you ever dated somebody just because you were lonely?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then the thing was like, better to be lonely. Better just to be and sit with lonely than to let a predator in or someone who's not qualified to date you, because we forget that we have worth and we shouldn't just throw ourselves out there to anybody who finds us interesting. Oh, you find me interesting? I'll date you. We have to have high standards of who we let into our life, who we let into our home, who we let into our bed, who we let into our hearts. These are we have to raise that bar, yeah. Instead of like, I'm lonely, I'm going to take anybody. We need a very high electric fence, because the problem. And I said, well, the problem with predators, once you let them in, it's hard to get them out.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get wrapped up in these bad relationships that started bad, and you're in there 8 years. You know, I think if we've been around the block a little bit, we know the story with this one.
All too well.
That was my sheep analogy.
Well, I loved it. But all right, so let's get back to that. And thank you for sharing that, because I think that's very important. I know a lot of the audience, I'm sure, can relate. Many of us, even right now as we're listening, are probably in relationships that, you know, are not serving our highest self. But so it's always nice to at least hear that, maybe plant a seed. But I definitely want to talk to you about, you know, you mentioned becoming a renunciate monk for about 6 years and, you know, shelter. And we started to go down that road. And in that time, I'm assuming you're starting to practice yoga or continuing to practice yoga. And here you are now, like a well-respected, celebrated yoga teacher. So if you don't mind talking a little bit about that journey, you know, so we started Youth of Today and here you are now. Still doing those reunion shows, but now you're also teaching yoga. You know, you're a bhakti, kirtan musician, and I'd love to hear a bit about that experience.
So I always practiced yoga even before I lived in the ashram, sure. And which was a unique thing back then, because I knew Jiva Mukti Yoga and I knew Dharma Mitra, who was my yoga teacher, and Integral Yoga. Those are the three yoga schools I've ever heard of in New York City.
Yeah.
Now everybody runs a yoga school.
Of course.
And not only that, yoga's become incredibly secularized, where it's just sort of like a flow class. We're in a flow class, and there's an overall feeling of endorphins release and a feeling of a high after yoga, and I'm laying in Shavasana and the teacher speaks in a very quiet voice and says Shanti a few times or a couple of like love yourself. And but I wasn't drawn to yoga to do hand. I mean, I teach all that tricky handstands and advanced asanas. That's not why I was drawn to yoga. I was never like an athlete, you know, type. I loved the ancient literature of yoga, the books on yoga, what the sages taught about yoga. That was my in. You know, I love the concept of meditation, of chanting, of kirtan, of, you know, that there's one divine being in religion. All religions meant to get to that divine being. There's no one's got a monopoly on divinity. You know, that's how I just sort of internally sort of grew up with it. And so That was why I wanted to know about yoga. I wanted to learn about sacred literature. I got into yoga because I first heard about Ayurveda because I had a calling to be a vegetarian when I was 18. No one, you know, not many people were vegetarians back then. So it was a very sort of unique calling. But I just had this concept like, wait a second, I like dogs and cats. Why would I see them as people, with these other animals as commodities? It seemed to me like I was creating like a, you know, a sociopath's mind, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. One sense I'm like, oh, you are my best friend. And another sense like, you are a commodity. You, I'm going to eat your corpse, and you, I'm going to pet your corpse. I started realizing like, wait a second, this isn't good for my brain to think like this. But I was Italian from a big Italian family, and I didn't know how to cook. And so I just said, well, when I move out of my mom's house, I'm going to, you know, not eat meat anymore. And so, that was my sort of like beginning into vegetarianism when I turned 18. Hmm. So then I got into Ayurveda because I needed some type of, you know, I was in New York City and there was probably Dr. Vasant Lad's only book out printed in English on Ayurveda. But I knew the Indians for a long time were vegetarian, so I wanted to figure out how to be a vegetarian. So I started studying Ayurveda, took some classes in Ayurveda. It was back like in 1986 or something. It's unbelievable. And then I was like, man, I want to hear what these yogis say about spirituality. That's why I started going to yoga classes. I didn't really care about doing a headstand. I really cared about my spiritual life. And that's sort of what drew me to, ultimately moving to an ashram when I was 22. You know, it was a healthy blend of misery and joy. I can't just say joy. It was sort of like excitement. My band got really popular. For a kid who's never done anything like that, that was like really fascinating.
Yeah.
Putting out records, you know, you'd call it material success. And then on the other side, my father got sick very suddenly, and he went into a coma for 3 years. And it was really shocking if you've never experienced any type of like real heavy loss, that was incredible for me to just swallow when I was 19. Like, no one knows if he's dead or alive. It's devastating. It was just really shocking for me. In one sense, you see the hope of material reality, and then you see like how the rug can get pulled out from you almost overnight. And I was really, really I was really sort of just like awakening to my spiritual life. Like, what if I die? Mm-hmm. Are we all going to die? It made me think about my own temporality. You never, until you really, and you know, we've all had different experience. Some people experience that loss at 5. Some people have like, everything's very solid in their life till they hit 35 perhaps. But then when our parents die perhaps, or we had a loved one that dies, it's like our whole world gets shaken up. So for me, that happened to me at 19. And by the time he did leave his body, I was very focused on my spiritual life. And I went to India then. That was in 1988. And so I always continued my yoga practice. And then when I moved out of the ashram, I started getting very interested in more of like a physical practice. And I never really thought about teaching yoga. I just enjoyed it. And then I just like to live like a yogi. Yeah. You know, I never thought about it because I still was doing music. And yoga was just my life. I never thought of it as a career.
Yeah.
And then I was living in LA at the time and really just doing yoga 6 days a week. I did yoga and Brazilian jiu-jitsu. That's all I did really. And I would tour for a few months a year, make a chunk of money and just, you know, do yoga and jiu-jitsu all day. I mean, that was sort of like the life I led. That was the pre-kid life I led. I started someone asked me to substitute class. Some yoga teacher in Los Angeles, really nice lady, asked me to sub her classes, and I thought, sure, I'll sub, but I would like to do it my way. I don't know where you teach, but I like to do it my way. I like to bring a harmonium. I like to chant. That's how I teach. And she was like, I don't know, chanting might be a little peculiar. I teach it like Sports Club LA. I teach at Equinox. I was like, well, that's the way I'm going to teach. And, you know, whenever you chant in class or speak philosophical in class, there's always people, if they just want to work out, it's always like, what the hell are you doing?
Right.
But there's some people that are like, oh, that was pretty nice. And after a while, I just realized, like, it was probably after my second class I started, actually, I love doing this exponentially more than I love doing music, than being in a band. Yeah. Like, I actually don't even enjoy being in a band that much. I enjoy just speaking, you know what I mean? And being a yoga teacher, when people are actually looking for that stuff, and after a while, the people that know what you're about, they either come to you or they just stay away from you.
Right.
You know what I mean? If they know you're going to speak on philosophy and you're going to chant in class, if they like that, they come. If they don't like that, they stay away. You know, and it attracts the right people to you. So I just started doing my own thing and living like – so. And it was great because I got to integrate my my years of study and my passion for the lifestyle of a yogi into just like doing that on a regular basis. It was and still is, you know, incredibly pleasurable.
And I think the your time, you know, in your bands didn't hurt either, because I remember taking that workshop with you at Snowshoe, the one where you were telling stories and chanting, and it was beautiful. But I remember thinking, like, this man has a lot of, you know, stage presence in him. You know, like, you're the front man of many bands. Like, I'm sure you've got to know that that has impacted you in some way. Like, you know how to, I don't want to say work the crowd, because you're not. I know you're coming from a heart space, but you, like you were saying earlier, it's not a bad thing to have that charisma. And I mean, where else can you develop? Well, you can develop it in a lot of places, but I mean, on stage, you know, like, you develop it up there, your passion. And I noticed that, you know, when I took your class.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you play a show for three people.
Yeah.
I play shows in front of 200,000 people. Yeah. It's just like, you learn how to, truthfully, it's a simple art of public speaking, which,
yeah,
very interestingly enough, people can, you know, the number one biggest fear in the world is public speaking.
Over death.
Number two fear is death. Number two, people would rather be
dead. That's nuts.
I know. So for me, I was always pretty comfortable speaking publicly, and I was forced to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have a lot of prep. I know I teach people to be yoga teachers, so that's one of the big things. It's not doing the yoga asanas or how to teach the yoga asanas or how to assist the poses. How do you get up in front of 30 people and not just like freeze up?
Yeah.
So, and that's just a practice too.
Right. Yeah. I remember there's a story Tara Brach had shared in one of her books, I think Radical Acceptance, about a teacher who got up on stage and he completely froze, and he just naturally went back to his breath because he'd been meditating for so many years. He'd actually forgotten where he was. It was like a really bad experience. And then he came back. And then he just gently, I don't know if it's 5-10 minutes, started his Dharma talk. You know, it's because that was his natural way of being, like, years and years and years. That's what he came back to without forcing it. And that's, how cool is that, man? Like, you come back.
Right. You just apply what you've been doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have about like 10 minutes left, and I know you just launched your new website. I know you take tours to India. I want to take the rest of this time to kind of open it up to you, and what would you like to talk about? I know, first of all, I know you have a ton of stuff coming up. I was looking at your website. Can you share the address with the audience?
Raghunath, R-A-G-H-U-N-A-T-H, Raghunath. .yoga.
Thanks.
.yoga instead of a .com.
I love that you got .yoga. And I'll have that listed for our audience, whether you're listening or watching. We'll list that.
And we just opened this farm, so we have different events happening at the farm, which are pretty cool. We do a sadhu training, which is it's a men's retreat where we just go up in the woods and we learn primal skills,
cool,
as well as kirtan and chanting and meditation and sleeping under the stars. We do like bhakti study weekends. We just had one called Chant Camp, which is the study of musical instruments and kirtan. We're doing another bhakti immersion in August. Basically, you know, sacred literature, kirtan, where you get to just take a big fat weekend off and just dive into this stuff. And they're all incredibly joyous.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really fun. You walk away, everyone's like in a very blissful state. I'm doing some teachings. One of my big ones is, and it just sold out, is my, and it sells out every year, but it's one of my favorite things, is taking groups on pilgrimage throughout India. We just opened up one, our 2018 trip. And that's my favorite thing, is going to all my favorite places in India. Then I tell the stories of these places, what you do here. Otherwise, what happens when you go to India is you just sort of like park it in a retreat center, do some yoga class with your yoga teacher, and visit the Taj Mahal or something like that. Either go as a tourist, you go to your yoga teacher, and you stay somewhere in South India and go to the beach. To me, I don't want to go as a tourist. I don't want to go as a backpacker. I want to go as a pilgrim. And that's how I went. And so I trained the students how to go as a pilgrim. And we go to these sacred pilgrimage spots. It's very, very magical.
Yeah.
And then January I do, for those who are 200-hour teachers, I do a really special, like unprecedented 300-hour, makes them a 500-hour teacher, training in January. And I do that with my teacher, Radhanath Swami.
Yeah.
Excuse me. If you haven't read it, wrote that great book, A Journey Home, which was his story about an American coming to India in the 60s and his experience living in the Himalayas and et cetera, meeting Maharaji, meeting Swami Prabhupada and living with so many sadhus. It's a very beautiful story. But anyway, I do that training and he's a special guest. We train people in music for the month. We do Ayurvedic cooking, Ayurveda for yoga teachers. And I bring a bunch of really powerful sacred literature, advanced hands-on assists, as well as asana, pranayama, mudra, etc. So it's really a beautiful one-month study in India, too.
Just be careful of the monkeys.
Yeah, did I tell those monkey stories?
You told so many great monkey stories, and like you said, you could fill a whole class.
Write a book on monkey stories.
Just be careful of the monkeys. But, you know, I do want to say one other thing.
Did I tell you the story where I got close fist punched by a monkey once?
No, you literally punched.
Yeah. Right in the chest.
No, you told the one about him taking your sandal out of a store and you bartering to get it back, but I did not hear about it.
I thought I had it with me. It's got a bite mark still in it.
Oh, you got jacked up by a monkey, though. I'm sorry to hear that, man.
I was really excited. I was really excited because I thought Sanuk was going to be at Wonderlust because they gave me free Sanuk sandals last year. And they didn't this year, and I was upset because my sandals have a big monkey bite out of them. It took like a whole bartering system with me and the shop owner of like offering him a banana and a chigu, another type of, you know, sapote or whatever to, with the monkey to try to get that sandal back. And even still, he took a bite out of it.
That's damn monkeys. But you know what you did say? One thing I wanted to share before we closed on it, and maybe you can share some thoughts on this, but I really appreciated how you'd said in that class as well. You know, a lot of people were very grateful to you. You're obviously very well versed in what you've studied, and you're a wonderful bhakti. And a lot of people were thanking you and thanking you for your authenticity and your integrity. And I remember you said, well, don't thank me, thank my teachers. And that just like struck such a chord with me, because for me, when people thank me, it's a self-worth thing. It's like, I don't deserve it. You know, I'm still a shitty human being. But when you said that, it was like, wow, like, yeah, man, thank my teachers that taught me. I love, if you have any, maybe we could close on that. Any comments or thoughts on that?
It's a powerful teaching that I teach, and I teach it because my teachers taught it to me, is that we don't embrace praise. Mm. We dodge it.
Yeah.
Our biggest issue in yoga is not our tight hips, it's not our lower back, it's not our tight neck, it's not my flabby whatever, it's my ego. And so instead of being sniffing around for praise, we do what's appropriate and honest and real, is if you like something about me, it's because I got it from somebody else. If you like something, now I've had people say to me, no, Raghunath, I've heard your teacher say this, but it's the way you say it that I really love. And I get that because it's coming out of the Raghunath vehicle, and maybe they wouldn't relate to my teacher. But in my heart, if it wasn't for my teacher, you would get a much different version of me. Mm-hmm. And I remember that version of me. So in that sense, I will give the praise back to my teacher. because the teacher becomes like, what, you ever see those guys who, you know, work the trains, you know, they just, you know, the trains come down the track, there's a little man in a booth and he pulls a lever and instead of going south, now the train's going north.
Yeah.
He right. just corrects. So like I was saying before, you have charm, you have charisma, you have musical ability, you have artistic ability, you have, you know, you have intelligence. It's not like the teacher gave you that, but what the teacher does is taught you how to engage that towards light instead of darkness. The way culture was teaching me and my ego was fueling me, I was taking all those good qualities and using it in a way that was not uplifting, which was not cleansing my consciousness. It was degrading my consciousness. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we do thank the teacher, not because he gave me musical ability, but he showed me what to sing about.
Yeah.
Not because he gave me great intelligence, but he taught me what to study, or she taught me what to study. Not because they gave me great artistic ability, but they taught me what to paint. And how the mood should be behind the paint. So, yeah, we always offer our prayers to our teachers 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night, to remember, especially when I go into a yoga class. You know, sometimes I'll teach a class in a weird place. I never go and maybe pack with people. It's very easy for my ego to go, yeah, I'm very cool. Look at all these people. I must be doing something. But it's not – that's – the red flag should go up. It should be by the mercy of my teacher. These people are here. How can I serve them? Right. Or I think of even better than that. I think these people were sent by my teacher for me to take care of, for me to love. Mm. It's a nicer way to look at it.
I love that.
Indemnifies me from that ego that wants to catch me, you know, and it keeps me in the mood of I'm doing this in service. And therefore, if it's a packed class or a packed, you know, concert or something, or if there's one person there or 3 person, you feel like, this is what has been sent to me today to take care of and to love and to nurture, you know. Now you're indemnified from, oh, there's only one person. I suck.
Yeah.
Or there's a million people. I'm the best. And I'm, you don't, who wants to ride that roller coaster?
Yeah.
I'm the best. I'm the worst. It gets old quick. I'm here to give love.
And that you are, my friend. And that's a great, great lesson that I took home with me from Wanderlust, and I've kept close to my heart in talks I've given since, and remember, it's very important. So thank you for that wisdom amongst
the good work yourself. I'm looking forward to connect again and yeah, come up and visit the farm.
You know I will, sir. We'll get that together with Kylie and we'll have a little powwow up there and it'll be great. So
looking forward.
Yeah.
So Raga Yoga or supersoulyoga.com.
Cool.
You can get farm links there.
Great. We'll have it all linked up on the page. And I will definitely at a later date have you back on the show because I know we just began to scratch the surface of really what we could get into. But this is a great, I think, introductory session.
We've only just begun.
I love it. All right, my friend.
My brother, great to see you. I'm looking forward to coming up and hanging out.
Absolutely. Very soon. Be well, my friend.
All right. Ciao.
Take care.
Howdy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.